Welcome, Garland listeners, to another conversation with a key craft thinker from around the world, a very special person, Urmila Mohan, who is the founder of the Jugaad Project, which I must admit is one of the publications that I really look forward to arriving in my feed, because there's an extraordinary range of articles about material culture from across the world, which show that the value and the richness of handmade objects in people's lives, not just in galleries, but in their cultural practices. For instance, there was one recently, Lalita Waldia, her article on Lakai, which is a form of wood carving in Uttarakhand in India, which is a wonderful wood carving that is to an extent languishing, but she talks about how well it's connected with their culture. And it's very hopeful in the sense that her work is giving dignity to what they're doing, will hopefully encourage it. So we have an opportunity to listen to Urmila tell us about the origins of this very interesting open source publication, very generous. She's an independent scholar who has studied a wide range of areas. She wrote a book called Fabricating Power in Balinese Textiles. And I will include a link to her bibliography in the show notes. But meanwhile, greetings, Urmila. Can you tell us where you are at the moment?
Hi, Kevin. Yes, I am right now in Brooklyn, New York. So very much part of the Indian diaspora.
I see. Well, welcome across the Pacific Ocean. So if we could get down to it, can you tell us about the idea of the Jugaad Project and how it came about?
Well, the Jugaad Project basically is about material religion, which is the study of material culture in religious practices. And the current incarnation, if you want to call it that, was in 2019. But it's based on an earlier iteration, which was called the Material Religion Blog. And that had received quite a bit of traction, especially with scholars and students in the kind of niche field of material religion, material culture, craft, making, anything to do with these manifestations, these material manifestations. And it started with my own experiences as a doctoral student, with all the excitement of, you know, being fully engaged with your doctoral research and wanting to take those ideas further. I met another collaborator who was working on rituals in South America, John McGraw, and together we founded the Material Religion Blog. That had a good life for about, I would say, 6 years. I think I wanted to take it forward in the form that is known as the Jugaad Project right now, because I felt that my ideas had grown since then. So basically, it's the Jugaad Project, and the tagline is Material Religion in Context, which is kind of the thing that only an anthropologist would say. So context is everything for us.
Right. And of course, Jugaad is a much more condensed word, but what does it mean, and why did you use that word?
Right. That's kind of an answer where I think the reasoning kind of keeps kind of evolving and changing every few years. And I think the broad explanation is this notion of searching far and an epistemology that was from the global south, searching for ideas about practice and making, which I felt that had so much potential and could be developed and could probably kind of converge with these ideas of bricolage and making do as we get in the Western academic tradition. So this notion of living every day, making connections with things, I think I found all of those contained within this term, but there was also a very nice resistance. There was something about this term that was resisting what I was trying to do with it. And I felt there was so much more to expand. Traditionally, the idea means if you go on the internet and you put in Jugaad, it just means you know, is they talk about it as everyday innovation, as something that's quotidian but innovative, a new way of doing things. If you put that into your browser for images, you end up seeing how objects are jerry-rigged together. So the connotation, the popular connotation, seems to be hacking, and is also seen as a kind of a critique of how, you know, cheap things can become. But I wanted to repurpose that term and make it more about creativity, more about knowledge making, and how making these connections, the process of living and crafting and making, is about making these connections. So that's pretty much the essence and the potential of Jagard for us.
Okay, so you obviously have an extensive network of scholars and writers that you could draw on for this. And tell me, since you've started the project, you know, what have you discovered in terms of the kind of work that's happening and the stories that have been attracted to your platform?
We do find that our audiences keep changing and that our writers keep changing also. And what has really struck me, and I've been surprised by, is number one, the sheer need for this platform. I had not realized that there was actually a paucity of spaces where not just earlier career scholars or doctoral students or people in the crafts and arts, but anybody dealing with materiality as a serious pursuit, wanting access to academic ideas, which are most often behind subscription paywalls. It was just the surprise of realizing that there was an actual need for this. And we see this every year with every call for issues, call for proposals for our issues. We see the numbers increasing. It's very exciting because I get to meet a new generation of scholars through every issue. So diversity is truly something I think I could say that we have a range of opinions, both in terms of the contributions and the themes that people are writing about, as well as who the people themselves are and where they are located, whether it's in Asia, Africa, the Americas. So I think that relationship between the global North and South is something I take very seriously. And we're always looking for those kind of writers who are invested in those spaces and willing to or able to articulate those stories to the rest of the world. I think that's pretty much the way that ideas have extended from the interdisciplinary collaborations that we have created between material culture studies, social sciences, cultural history, classical studies, archaeology, religious studies, design, art, and craft studies. So that's what you get to see. You get this very rich tapestry of ideas.
It's fascinating you talk about discovering a need for this platform. In most academic journals, of course, service a need for publications within an academic career, and that's very easily formalized. What do you think, in particularly in terms of independent scholars, how does it help for them to be published in the Jagard project?
I think you hit on something very, very important. It's also a sensitive topic, so it's difficult to talk about, with the kind of nuance, but I'll try. I think that there is a real dearth of actually, as you said, thinking about these ideas as public-facing ideas, as ideas that go into the world and make change, right? One of the biggest critiques that we get from younger scholars increasingly is, yes, we have these ideas, but they are either gatekept or they're behind subscription walls. And most people, to be frank, even my colleagues who are young designers, artists, or people studying crafts in Asia, for example, would have no access to those ideas, they know of those journals, but getting access to it is a different issue. It's more the idea that if you put careerism in the background, and if our goal is not about just advancing our resumes and putting these titles out there and maybe getting in more and more publications, what does knowledge actually do in the world? And I think that's a very exciting and challenging, but a very, very difficult thing to do.
Well, we're very interested in the full circle at Garland, how it is that the stories we publish have an impact for those whose works are written about. Have you come across any instances where something being published in the Jugaad Project had an impact on the people who were written about?
It would happen more, I would say, more indirectly. I would say also the people being written about, if they are the actual artists and artisans and craftsmakers, that's definitely something that affects them directly. But I think mostly as of now, it would happen through, for example, if I'm working with a designer in Indonesia, or I'm working with an artist in Bali, and I'm working with them on helping curate their ideas or develop their ideas, that's a very direct, way of getting their work out, but also giving them the academic or intellectual support that they need or access that they need to kind of put their ideas in a form that more people can access it. I think that's an example of something that's direct.
Now, many of the stories in Jugaad Project concern religious practice, which tends to be consigned, you know, within the terms of a tradition that is relatively timeless, that doesn't necessarily evolve and therefore is not considered particularly creative or artistic. What do you think of this distinction, and how has the Jugaad Project been able to question it?
Well, I mean, first of all, of course, I mean, I'm trying to understand better what you mean when you say that the tradition is timeless. Is it the perception that craft as a tradition is timeless? Is that what you're getting at?
One of the areas we hope to look at next year is what occurs within the temple or the church or the mosque, which often involves the construction of deities, offerings, all kinds of vestments, all kinds of things, which particularly with the diasporas occurring in your country and mine, Australia, there's a lot of activity in building these temples. I know there was, I think, one of the world's largest temples recently constructed in New Jersey, yes, around the corner from you. And this isn't necessarily something which is considered part of the, say, the craft world, because it occurs within a sacred context rather than a gallery or a shop. And I think the perception is that what occurs in the sacred spaces is to an extent very much defined within the limits of that religion rather than somehow responding to the creativity of the makers and the communities.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think that we're seeing more kind of scholarship on that specifically. For example, when I did my doctoral work, I think the issue that you run up against is this notion, and of course, and to a large part it's true, that, you know, there's an orthopraxy, right? There's a way that things are done within a religious community for that particular material manifestation, let's call it, you know, craft. So for that particular crafting of the deity's clothing, you know, the architecture, if we think of architecture as a form of crafting. And it's super interesting that you pointed out the example of new temples in the diaspora, because so much has been written and is still being studied, is that it's such a dynamic process that kind of, if we could call it, the reinvention of tradition or the resituating of these traditional forms in new landscapes. There are, of course, elements that we recognize immediately as being traditional or particularly or true to a particular cultural form. But, and I think this is why I love anthropology and ethnography, that when you actually go and study the space, or you actually spend time with the people, you realize how many negotiations and navigations are involved. So I think if we look at these, not so much just within the term of craft or art, but as practices, and we kind of step back for a second, and kind of open up those boxes, and you think of them as practices, of course, what are the goals of those practices? You know, those goals are, of course, to elevate whatever divinity they worship, but there's also a very strong social aspect to it. So I think it's that coming together of the sociality and the materiality in those spaces, whether it's the temple or a church or a mosque or any other space, that's fascinating. And I think that could probably speak to also the strength of what the Jugaad Project does, which is we take these terms like craft and art and museums and these spaces very seriously, but we also think about the through line. What is the thread that connects all of these processes of making together, which is, I think, practices.
Right. Well, one of the practices that I think you've written about personally, and forgive me if I take advantage of this moment to introduce our current issue, which is around touch. And one of the articles is about the komboloi, which is the Greek worry bead. And this evolved out of the Islamic prayer beads. And I note that in your CV, you have written about the Hindu prayer beads, which obviously is a form of practice both in the making and the use. Can you say a little about what you found interesting in the Hindu prayer beads?
I think what was fascinating about, and I think you're referring to a paper that I wrote for Techniques, and it was an issue of compiled volume on Techniques. And this is why technology is also so useful. So we move away from this idea of high tech. You know, technology is not just high tech. Technology is anything that we use in these practices, even something as simple and seemingly basic as the shape and form of these prayer beads. What was absolutely fascinating and through those prayer beads was beginning to understand the effects of making and doing something, the action of repetitive motions of those beads and the effects that they have both on the person who's doing those actions, as well as, of course, those paraphernalia kind of forming a kind of social skin between the person performing the action and the world, which identifies them as a devotee of, you know, or a believer or a faith practitioner of some kind. And I'm so glad that you pointed out to something very, very small, very, very detailed, and almost invisibilized in our larger discussions about things that are, you know, have more aesthetic power or kind of perceived as having more spiritual power, because this truly is about the body. It's the body and the material. So this notion of how do the body and the material work together is something that I discovered. And the study of the prayer beads, of course, the realization that people are innovating even with that technology. People are not stagnant. If there are contexts in which they cannot carry their prayer beads and their bead bags, they will find a way to innovate, you know. So you will probably take a tally counter, you know, tally counter like the one that you use to tally people entering a show, or maybe the kind of tally counter they use to clock off how many items are on a shelf. And this is absolutely fascinating for someone like an anthropologist like me, because you notice that an act of counting is what it's all about, but also remembering something, right? So it's this constant negotiation between living in this world with its limits and its immanence and its context, but you also want to continue hitting your count of, you know, japas or your chanting numbers that you've kind of promised to do as an initiate. So that's a fascinating example of where a crafted object is about use, about function, and also about negotiating and navigating this person through this world while they're constantly thinking about something that is otherworldly.
Yes, well, what I found interesting about the Kombolo in a similar way was that it's spoken of often as something therapeutic, that the use of it, keeping the hands busy, is a way of dealing with some of the kind of worry that we carry with us in everyday life. And it struck me that the rise of the fidget spinner in recent times perhaps answers to a similar kind of need, but it points to this contrast between the konbolloi as a cultural signifier, is something which has a meaning in terms of Greek identity and is sometimes passed down as an heirloom. Contrast between that and a fidget spinner, which is the kind of thing you find at a supermarket checkout, something very disposable without the same kind of meaning at all, very uninteresting to look at, and so on. And perhaps it's an example of how the kind of scholarship that you're involved in helps us perhaps revalue some of these traditions that have passed by, seeing that they are speaking to something which is quite universal.
I absolutely agree. And I think that the example of the fidget spinner also is a fantastic one, because it points to both the potentials and the possibilities, as well as the, can we say, the dangers of what happens when, you know, a practice is, of course, commodified like that and you know, universalized in that way, but not in the same way as you talk about, you know, the body having certain needs. You know, what is it to live in today's world? What does craft do? Craft meets a very, very strong existential need. And this is why perhaps at this particular moment in history, people like you and I are talking about these issues, which is what is it to live and survive in this world? And how can we think of a future that is better?
As we're coming to an end, Amila, I wonder if you could just give us a couple of examples of stories that you featured in Jugad Project to give the listeners a feel of some of the rich content that they can look forward to when they visit the website.
Well, I could actually do a very quick run through just of the issues we worked on, the themes of the issues, starting from 2019. It was much, things like landscapes, innovation, color. And then, of course, with the pandemic happening in 2020, this whole idea of what's happening to our world, you know, what are the fractures and ruptures happening? How do we respond to that? And I think ever since we've been in that kind of responsive mode of cohering the world, and we talked about rebuilding, we've talked about healing. And it's very interesting that against that background, craft again makes an appearance. So our spring 22 issue is about craft. And it does include that mention that you made earlier, Kevin, of the article on Lalita Waldia's article on Likai. So we also have articles, for example, on bamboo weaving development in Java. Of course, the sacred double eco textile of Bali, which is called ginseng. And also closer home to India, the infrastructure needed to support something like Durga Puja idol making. So I think craft is eternally a fertile area for us to be working on. And the future, I just hope to take that forward in other spaces, including our most recent issue, which is about work. So, you know, what is work and how would you think of something as craft versus, work or maybe craft work? So I would encourage people to please just visit our site, the jugadproject.pub, and PUB is our extension. And just throw yourself into the tapestry of what we have there.
Well, we certainly hope that the Jugad project continues in its current format for much longer. I'm very sure there's a rich set of stories still to be shared. But I'm wondering if there are any other plans. I see that you've started to publish books, is that right, of the journal? Are you thinking about possibilities of, say, a conference or exhibition or any other kinds of extensions?
Yes, that's exactly it. I think with the book, we try to establish a kind of a intellectual foundation for the work we're doing, and all of the authors in the book, many of them were from previous collaborations. The book is, of course, called The Efficacy and Intimacy of Belief in World Making. It just comes out. We have a book discussion coming up in January, so please join us if you can. In terms of future events, we'd love to increase the visibility of this project, which hopefully we're doing right now while talking to Garland. And we really hope to start thinking about getting people in person, physically forming relationships with each other, and creating those communities. So it's not more virtual as well as an in-person. So the point being that Jagat is all about relationships. It's all about context. So wherever we can build these relationships and spaces, we are happy to go there.
Well, may it flourish. Umila, thank you so much for sharing part of this journey, and I certainly encourage our listeners and readers to extend their reading beyond Garland to Jagad Project for the way it gives anthropologists in particular a way of sharing their knowledge outside of the gated halls of academia, as you mentioned, Umila. It's a very generous project and something which I think we should all support. So go well. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kevin. It's been such a pleasure talking with you.
You've been listening to a podcast from Garland Magazine. Please check our website, garlandmag.com, for more stories behind what we make.